Thanks, Bill. And I do have to thank Bob and Carol Nichols for all of their introductions in Naples. And I'm going to just give you a... I'm not going to talk about what it means to be lead director, because the best lead director is to be seen and not heard. That's the most effective way, and that's culturally one of the things we have to begin to adapt in this country. But it's really my pleasure to introduce you to Lloyd Blankfein, who's the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs. Let me give you a little context of how I got to know Lloyd and when I joined the board of Goldman Sachs in 2009. That was a pivotal year in the early days of the global financial crisis. And I can tell you, a lot of people would write to me and say, why would you ever want to join a board at that point in time, in particular in the financial services? But the firm had gone from being venerated for its risk management practices and capacity to weather the storm to very quickly the focus, as you saw, I'm sure, on some of the congressional hearings, of intense scrutiny as the sentiment shifted to the industry's shortcomings amidst the broader calamity. This was not a situation that Goldman was accustomed to, and suffice it to say, it was a trying time wherever one sat on any of these issues. Many, however, myself included, will nevertheless remember the consistency of leadership, the stamina and single-minded resolve that Lloyd demonstrated as he navigated the firm and its people through this period. The demands on him personally were incessant, and you couldn't even begin to understand what they were on him and his family. And those closest to him will attest that nobody at Goldman Sachs internalized these circumstances more or worked harder to resolve them than Lloyd. From his role in leading an examination of the firm's business and standards practices, to helping to recraft regulatory oversight for the industry broadly, to launching initiatives pinned to economic growth, to positioning Goldman Sachs and its shareholders for this evolving landscape. Lloyd has been a strategic thinker, a staunch force for sensible reform, and a steady hand during this transition period. So with this, I want to also tell you that Lloyd, over 30 years among his roles, has also served as the firm's president and chief operating officer, as well as vice chairman with management responsibility for the firm's global sales and trading businesses. He is currently a member of the Dean's Advisors for both Harvard Law School and Harvard Business School. I know some of you are surprised to see a lawyer in Lloyd's position, but it does happen. On the Dean's Council at Harvard University, and is a member of the advisory board of Tsinghua University of Economics and Management in Beijing. Lloyd also sits on the boards of the Weill Cornell Medical College and the Partnership for New York City. So, Lloyd, we're delighted that you're here with us today, and we look forward to your remarks and insights during the Q&A.
Thanks, Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Jim, and I'll tell you, let me help you out. Anybody who's looking for what does it mean to be a lead director, it means that when you ask your chairman and CEO to come and speak at a conference in southwestern Florida, your chairman says, yes, sir, when would you like me to show up? Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I have to say I have, I personally, but also Goldman Sachs, and frankly, the broader financial system has a huge, owes a huge debt to Jim, because he did come in 2009, which is not a period of time for the faint of heart. It was crazy. And by the way, people were looking for targets and for opportunities. And just because you'd missed the bulk of the crisis didn't mean you were weren't susceptible to receiving a lot of criticism once you got to a position of responsibility. And Jim came in at that time, showed and I tell you, I don't use this word lightly, great courage, because he immediately took over our audit and risk committee. Can you imagine that? The risk committee of Goldman Sachs, and did a spectacular job and was a great, great director and a great partner to me personally. So I'm very grateful, and I would have come here anyway, Jim. Listen, I thought I'd speak for about half the time, a few minutes, and then stand for questions and answer, which is always fun for me to respond to the topics that you direct to me. But at the outset, I'm going to talk about three areas that I normally would get asked about anyway, and that is to talk a little bit about the economic environment around the world. Second, specific things in that context that I'm worried about. And by the way, my list of worries is endless, so I'm just going to skim the top. And then third, I'm just going to comment on some other trends that I'm seeing we've come across in my business that I think are relevant to people here as well. So just first on the world economy and just taking a tour of the world. And I should say, I spend about a third of my time traveling outside the U.S. I spend more than half my time traveling, but I don't even count domestic travel. I go from here, tomorrow night I leave for Europe, I come back a couple of days, I go to Beijing, which will be my first trip back after the new leadership had their confab, the third plenum, and we'll get a run down there. But let me just take you a bit of tour of the way we think of things. In the U.S., once again, the September-October period was dominated by issues related to the government shutdown, but really the debt ceiling, the possibility that the U.S. would default. We had some experience in that. We had that in August of 2011, and in some ways this was dreaded and it was terrible. And by the way, it postponed a lot of decisions. These things are very bad for the economy. You know, if you are somebody, if you are a CEO of a company, if you want to sell or buy a house, so in other words, these are great decisions. People who have great thoughts get stopped by this, but anybody can understand it. And you think something's going to happen that's going to tank the stock market and cause values to drop. Are you going to do anything just before something like that happens, or are you going to wait till we come out the other side of it? Of course, you're going to wait till we come out the other side of it. And that's what you do as an individual, and that's what companies do, and that's what institutional investors do. Not everyone, but a lot of people. And it takes growth down, and it's very bad. And it basically puts things in what we would call a risk-off mode. Nobody wants to take risk in the run-up to that. Now, after we've got through that, it didn't seem like that big a deal, and that's for two reasons. One, having had the experience in 11, people really didn't think it was going to happen, but you had to prepare for it. We had to prepare for it. We're in the business of clearing and settling money, and so we had to go through all the pace as if it were going to happen. But really, in our hearts, we didn't think it was going to happen. And secondly, it didn't make much of a difference because when it didn't happen, they said, well, it can happen in another 3 months. And so it wasn't as bad in the run-up, but it also wasn't as good in the aftermath. And we're still kind of in that mode, which is still slowing things down from where it otherwise would be a tick. If you look through that self-inflicted, and, you know, we have to deal with a lot of events, you know, storms, terrorism, things that are imposed on the United States. This one is self-inflicted. If you put aside the self-infliction of, you know, the poison atmosphere in Washington that doesn't even allow you to pay off the credit that you've already undertaken, things are pretty good, actually. Third quarter growth came in a lot higher. Housing prices are up almost 14% this year. Sentiment is better. Corporate earnings are there. We're climbing a wall of worry. There's a lot of people, and I would say people are still, you know, for lack of a better word, kind of miserable in a lot of places, a lot around the world. People are saying, my goodness, the economy is growing too slowly. The trajectory should be higher. This is wrong. The poison politics feeds into it. Focus on Obamacare and the glitches associated with it. But if you separate yourself from the sentiment and you looked at the facts, again, the real growth in the economy, the real situation in energy in the United States, where we're so blessed with energy resources to an extent that we never thought, no one who grew up when we did ever thought, you know, the whole macro situation in the world for most of our lives was how do we get energy from all the worst places in the world? And geopolitics followed from that, war, expenditures on the military. That's not a fact anymore. We're going to be energy, if not energy independent, energy neutral. We'll still import some things, export other things, but we're going to be balanced as a continent and probably down the road even as a country. But again, sentiment is a lagging indicator. We had a very big trauma, and it's taken a long time to sort out. But I think the equity markets have it right. I think the economy is growing. I know the economy. In fact, that's not even a question anymore. The economy is growing. And if anything, things break to the high side rather than the low side is my best guess. In other words, at a low case, we muddle through and it gets better slowly. But I say there's risks of things going wrong, but I think there's a greater risk that the economy and the markets melt up rather than melt down. And by the way, that's what's happening now. The equity market is at record levels. Does it feel like that to anybody? No. Most people are underinvested, not overinvested, not uncommon. By the way, it was like this on the way down. When the market crashed, and remember the subprime, that was early 07. The equity market made its highs at the end of 07. So for an entire year, we're rationalizing the problems. Subprime is limited. It's not going to affect the wider mortgage market. From the wider mortgage market, it's not going to affect the credit market. It's limited to professionals. That wasn't the case. That was a bit of a bubble, and people didn't believe it. But I think there's a bit of an upside-down bubble going on also, where people are not recognizing some of the things that are constructive. And by the way, people look at QE and the removal of QE as another excuse not to make decisions and not to go forward. And there's some, and that's true also. But that's because they're looking at QE as the first step towards normalization in the economy that will be taken. And everyone's wondering, can this economy make it without the Fed artificial support from the Fed? The fact of the matter is, there's been a lot of that support already removed this year, and the growth we're seeing is in the face of that. The most important prop to the economy was the budget deficit, how much more money we were spending than what we were taking in. And half of that was eliminated this year. Raising taxes, sequestration, you may not have liked it, but it moved the budget process halfway towards complete normal. And long-term rates, which were 1.5%, are 125 basis points higher, closer to normal. And the growth that they were seeing is in the face of all that, you know, call it normalization and withdrawal of the artificial support. So again, I think, and I don't have to say what, the markets are higher. I think the markets have it right, you know, but we'll see. And, you know, sometimes when I think about it, if you ask me what period this seems like, when I got out of school in the late 70s, inflation was over 10% and unemployment was well over 10%. Imagine having to deal with the economy today of unemployment, which is killing us at 7%. When 35 years ago it was over 10%, and then what would you do if inflation was, instead of zero, was over 10% at the same time? That's what we went through. By the way, a depressed economy, the end of the Carter administration, beginning of the Reagan administration, very pessimistic about the economy, very pessimistic about the country at that time, and it was the start of a 20-year bull market. That's not mandated. It doesn't have to be that way. But it could be that way. I think the pessimism could be overdone here. Europe has a different set of issues. The structure of, you know, Europe has the complexity of the Eurozone and basically sovereign issues of federalism where, a single currency, single money policy, Germany, which is doing better than the peripheral countries in the south of Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, obviously, that you really would like to have one monetary policy for the south and one monetary policy for the north, but it doesn't work like that way when you have a single currency. But you have divergent fiscal policies, and it's a bit of a mess. Now, I don't speak, you know, in the interest of time. I'll just summarize to say that over the last, a year or 2 years ago, That was the biggest problem facing the world. The idea of Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland were like dominoes, analogous to the way Bear Stearns, Lehman, Merrill Lynch, you know, could have been dominoes in the 08 period. The sovereign crisis in Europe looked a lot like the banking crisis and the debt and the credit crisis in the U.S. And by the way, not entirely unrelated, but it didn't happen. And it's receded as a major concern of the world that that will go off the rails and create the kind of systemic risk that could blow everything up. And I think the Europeans were always comfortable with that, and the Americans weren't. And the difference is the Americans didn't appreciate that the will to protect the euro is absolutely complete in Europe. And it's not just among the elites, the political elite, which most people thought, well, gee, the political elite will do whatever it takes to protect the euro. And what does that mean? It means a lot of subsidies from Germany to the rest of the continent, and everyone's saying, well, the German citizens won't stand for that, even if the political elites were. And so everyone's very suspicious. But we just had an election in Germany where Mrs. Merkel won in a landslide, but that wasn't nearly as significant as the fact that they had a heated election where an anti-European party was running, and they didn't even get enough votes to get one seat in parliament, in their parliamentary system. That was a very big deal. And it just showed that in Europe, the history of the 20th century is still worn, is still on the front of people's minds. And we here can be cynical about that and think that that can't really be what's driving it. But it is. And the euro and the eurozone and all those compromises that are going to be that have been made or are going to be made, where Germany pumps a lot of value in, is a function of people thinking this is the only 60 or 70 years in 1,000 that there's been peace in Europe. And this is a political construct, not an economic construct, and they will do what it takes to make this happen, as long as they have the capacity to do it. So in order to preserve the euro, you need two things. You need the will, and you have to have enough money to make sure it doesn't fall apart if one of those countries teeters. I am confident they have a will, and for at least a long time, they have the capacity. Let's tune in a couple of years and make sure, because if this problem and the risk ever got to an economy the size of Spain, Italy, or France, and someone had to go in and cover that debt, then you have the issue of will, you certainly have the issue of capacity, but we're not there, and it's not in the top of my list of things to worry about now. On China. China is very important to all of us because the success or failure of China's economy is a lot of the incremental demand in the world. You know, think of demand like a commodity. If they find oil anywhere in the world, the luckiest people are the people who own that oil. But anybody who uses oil is just as lucky because that just becomes part of the supply, and it lowers the price, all other things being equal, it lowers the supply, the cost for everybody in the world, even though the luckiest people are the ones who own it. But it increases supply, demand stays even, price goes down. Demand is the same way generally in GDP. If China grows, people in China will have money to spend, they'll buy things. Some percentage of those things will come from the U.S. I wish it was more, and that's part of our competitive issue, but some of it will. And so when wealth is created anywhere, it does trickle across to everywhere. And that's a very important thing. In China, which is three-quarters our size, in the United States, the issue is the U.S. going to grow at 2.5% or 3.5% on our size economy. In China, people are wondering, is it going to grow 4% or 9%? And that difference is a bigger number, much bigger number than what we're debating about with respect to the U.S. And that's been a source of a lot of the tension in the world and driving a lot of markets and valuations. Material prices go up, commodity prices go up, they go down. People are eyeing China and the success. You know, there was an election in China. There is a kind of election in China, but only the Communist Party votes. But by the way, 80 million people, it really is. By the way, I do a lot of business in China. And China is a consensus-driven country. It's shocking to anybody who kind of understands the cliche and think of a fiat economy country where people order it and there's a supreme leader who on paper and on the organizational charge has complete authority over everything. It's completely consensus within the context of their very broad leadership group. And if you want to get something done, I have to go from ministry to ministry to ministry and try to get everybody to be coordinated, because anybody could almost block anything, because all the that's how it works there. It's kind of ironic in a way. But it's a big transition now, and they just had a big confab in China where the leadership get together. The leadership got the next level together and presented their effectively five-year plan, which is really a 10-year plan because they're always two terms. And it's reform, reform, reform. We don't have the details of it, but things will start to drift out. There's some things in the paper today, but we're not sure. But I'll tell you what reform means in China and why they have to do it and why it's so important. People in China, it's a fixed exchange controls. We, Goldman Sachs, can make investments in China, but if you're Chinese, you could put money in a savings account for an interest rate like the interest rates here, because the markets aren't open. They worry about convertibility. They have no access to buy things outside of China in terms of investment. There's no capital markets, which means a number of things. There's no price discovery. Things are made by fiat, but they've done a good job of getting things right. But a million decisions are made every day in the United States, and there it's done centrally. They have a pretty good track record, but it's not going to go on indefinitely. When we went out and we stimulated our economy, we invested in a lot of things that won't pan out. If we built something and nobody uses it, a road to nowhere, a hotel that nobody wants it, it won't make an income, it'll lose money, it won't be able to finance itself, it'll go bankrupt, it'll sell itself on an auction at a fraction of its original value, and somebody else will take it over. In China, they went out and built 82 airports. How many of those, when you decide, I'm going to build 82 airports because we need to keep people to work, how many of those are going to be in the wrong place? Well, a lot. How do you write them off? Well, they get financed. You know, state-owned enterprises, banks are government control, the local municipalities kind of dictate it. There's no mechanism for writing off mistakes, allocating capital, and that has to be done. Because there's no capital markets, there's no security, so you have big insurance companies are being built up, pension funds, safety nets. What do those pools of capital invest in? Companies, there are more billion-dollar companies in China than there are in the United States. We have more $50 billion companies. But tremendous groundswell of entrepreneurialism in China and companies. By the way, world-class companies being built. No real access to capital, no real access to the pools of savings in China. All these things are going to have to happen. We're there. We're, for example, we are a Chinese investment bank in China and a Chinese brokerage in China, but very regulated what you can do. Limited to how much capital we can bring in and therefore how much risk we can take and how many securities we can underwrite. Everybody's waiting for it to open up, but gradualism has been the watchword there, and the fact of our financial crisis has validated that point of view from their point of view. But what they're pushing in China is, what they've agreed to is a stable growth, but lower growth. China's had 10% growth for a long time. But it's a lot easier to have 10% growth when you can blast factor. If we didn't have an EPA in the United States, would growth be higher or lower? Growth would be higher. Would the quality of life be higher or lower? Lower. Lower. I mean, you'd like to breathe. I grew up in L.A. I worked my earliest jobs were in L.A. In the late 70s. You couldn't see from one building, you couldn't see the building across the street. That's what it's like in Beijing today. If you have to move those factories out, if you have to buy new equipment to do it, if you have to go out of certain industries entirely because they can't be done in a way that's good for the environment and allows people to breathe, you're going to have to give up some growth. But at least that growth is sustainable. And that's the track they're on in China. And, you know, we should all be rooting for them. Let me tell you the bottom line of all this. We invest in China when we can. We also harvest our investments when we can. And so what we do is our attitude toward that is stay invested. I feel better about investing for 20 years than I do for 2 years. I think this is going to be the century of China, just like the 20th century was the century of America. But we, century was a pretty good year, 20th century was a good century for America, but we didn't own every year of it. And if we'd gotten out in the first big panic in 07, we would have missed the last 93 years. And I think the same is going to be true of China. They're going to get growth, and I think it'll be very successful. The places in the world where I think are best to invest, United States, one, China, two. And I think Europe muddles through and will do better than people think, and it won't go off the rails. But I think I'd rather go to those places that are going to have higher growth. And by the way, one of the reasons why the United States always is going to do well, because people want to come here and make their money. When I was in China, in order to say something to flatter some of my hosts, and I really believed it, I said, no wonder why China does so well. You're able to draw on the expertise of 1.3 billion people. And without skipping a beat, said to me, well, you got us, you're better than us. You get to draw on the resources of 7.5 billion people, because everyone around the world would come to the United States if they could, including our 1.3 billion. Now, a couple of things I want to say, worrisome on the horizon. And this should also be in the good category, but it's also in the worrisome category. The nature of the regulation, which has come out now, all of which is necessary, necessary to regulate, necessary to have higher capital requirements, if not necessary, then predictable, that we'd want to have very high capital requirements and a lot of redundancies and safety. At some point, there's always going to be a trade-off between risk and reward. If you have so much capital and so much redundancy and channel people and restrict activities, you're going to make the world safe, but you're going to have the safety of a T-bill and you're going to have the returns of a T-bill. And what's going to happen is the pendulum is going to swing too far, and it won't be the banks that are going to be the arbiters. They shouldn't. Where you should be on the risk-reward spectrum is a social decision and a political decision. Banks should give their expert opinion, but the body politic, which bears the cost of disruption, will decide where that should be. But it may be, not shockingly, that after such a big trauma, you're going to err on the side of conservatism. Business people won't like that. And it's going to restrict activity, and it's going to make liquidity expensive, and it probably will be realized to be too much caution, not a surprise. If that's right, then the people who clamor for change will be the users of the market, which is kind of how that is happening now. But that's, that's something that we're going to get through. Excuse me, let me just get it. Can you pass me a glass? I'm just going to drink. Thank you. Next, technology is a big burden on the system. Big opportunity, big burden. And I'll just say, the following. Technology leverages things, but we had a little mistake in our in a pricing system at the end of August, and hundreds and thousands of securities were transacted at off-market prices. Those things can happen now, and I would say, prior to 50 years ago, in the history of the world, you couldn't have had a mistake in the financial system that would have cost $100 million. I can imagine you can have mistakes today that could cost billions of dollars. And by the way, that's true in every endeavor. In the industrial world, prior to 50 years ago, could you have had an industrial accident that could have killed 100,000, 200,000 people? Hard to imagine. Could you have an industrial accident today that could kill tens of millions of people? Yeah, look at Fukushima if the wind had gone differently. The nuclear plant after the tsunami. So technology is a set of problems that we have to deal with, and a subset of that is going to be cyber security and cyber terrorism, which we spend a ton of time on. And then the last thing I'd say is the inflexibility that's been built in the system by the government crisis. The government can't legislate, which means that if we had the crisis that we had in 08 and we had that today, what would happen? It's almost impossible to legislate. There's no flexibility. The legislation in Dodd-Frank took away powers from the Fed that were necessary for the system and largely beneficial. They were resented, but it was beneficial for the system. Look where we are today. Who thought 5 years later we'd be in this shape? But that's a danger and a threat now. I have a couple of things. I'm just going to end one thing because it's a positive note, and things on a list of things and trends because I want to leave some time for questions. And this also say this. This is something that's particularly relevant to the students here. There's never been a time in the history of this country or ever in the world where it's been so easy to innovate and be an entrepreneur. I know this from Goldman Sachs, and I know this because I have two kids and a daughter-in-law at the Harvard Business School. And I know, and so that's their peer group. But if you wanted to start a business any other time, as a few years ago when I thought it was easier than any other time, I'd say you could go to venture capitalists, raise your $5 million because you know who to go to. There's groups of angel investors, and it's all programs and protocols. I'll tell you, today, start a business, you don't even need the $5 million. Because now there are incubators, Amazon will provide the infrastructure and the technology. You need $500,000 to go out and do something and be a real company. And that's what's happening. That's what's driving this grassroots kind of every person, people don't want to go out and be, the dream now of kids in school is not to go out and go to a big institution. The really cool kids want to do startups, and the really cool kids want to drop out of school to do the startups. Now, this might be a kind of another form of Hoop's dreams, and it's going to leave a lot of people disappointed because it's not going to work out. But guess what? Kids, in the first years out of school, when I was growing up, spent 3 years, 3 years in the Army. This is a lot better. So even if it doesn't work out, not so bad. But I've never seen a place where it's so easy to start a business than it is today. And that's a very important trend for this country. Those of you who go to Silicon Valley or Silicon Alley in New York or the other centers that are around these schools know what I'm talking about, but it's absolutely extraordinary. Let me stop here because I saw some questions being generated.
So we have quite a few questions, and I'm fairly certain we're not going to get through all of them, but I try to. But I'm going to give you an easy one to start off with, Lloyd. And this comes from one of the students. What was your high school experience like? And did people ever think that you would be as successful as you are?
I grew up in East New York section of Brooklyn. Anybody here from New York? Brooklyn, New York? Anybody know the neighborhoods? Anybody know where East New York is? You know where the Linden Projects are? I grew up in the Linden Projects in East New York, Brooklyn, which was kind of a public. I grew up in public housing in New York. I went to a high school that was on triple session, which meant that they used the building three times in a day. I went my senior year. I went to school from 6:40 to 10:20, and then the school emptied out, and another crew came in at 11 to 2:30, and then another came at 3 to 6:30 or something like that. So mostly I went to school. We didn't have a marching band. We did have a police station in what had previously been the gymnasium. And so I had an experience of getting out of high school, to answer that question. But even college, I would say I just had a reunion from law school 35 years after I graduated from law school, and somebody said really nice, and I was the speaker at the Consolidated Alumni events that they had there in connection with the reunion, and more than one person came up to me in a very nice way, found a way of asking a question. When did you become smart? Because I was I was very highly mediocre place, and I didn't. But I was good enough to. I was kind of a B plus student at a hard school.
Okay, we're gonna have to answer these questions shorter.
I see my comments about the power of a lead director has gone to your head.
You think because most of the people in this room are retired, they want to spend the afternoon with you. Okay, so what is the future of the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency?
Good. There's a million reasons why we're taking advantage of it and we're putting it at risk, because we benefit a lot from being the world's reserve currency. We can finance our debt. Why can we finance our debt? Because China has no place to put $3 trillion other than in the U.S. dollar. So consequently, we can issue bonds. They buy them. If the U.K. needed the equivalent in financing, who's going to buy their debt? So, because it's not the reserve currency of the world. So we benefit from it, and we really don't deserve it, but guess what? Everyone deserves it less. And we're winning because there's no competitor to us, and there's not going to be for a very long time.
So there are several questions regarding where we are on QE2, low interest rates, where do you see interest rates going in the next 6 months? The impact that will have on growth, and
so
how much
policy,
of the economy is being driven by these artificially low interest rates. So
maybe I think the economy, comment. As I said, the economy has legs all by itself, but we've withdrawn some of the artificial pegs, but everybody's nervous about getting rid of the others. This shows, ironically, and some people have talked about this, the unintended consequences. Every time you try to prop something up, sometimes it has the opposite effect. I'll give you an example. In the middle of the crisis, this SEC barred short selling of financial firms. Now, I don't have amnesia. When that happened, I was happy, not sad, because we were under attack from hedge funds and other things. But one of the things that we noticed was shortly after that, stocks didn't go up, they went down. Why'd they go down? They may have stopped short sellers, but it stopped the buyers also. Why'd it stop the buyers? Because anybody who was buying at a price that cleared the market when people weren't allowed to sell the short weren't sure that was really the price, wasn't sure that was really the market clearing price. And nobody was going to buy a stock if 5 minutes later they're going to withdraw that rule and the stock, the stock was going to fall apart because the shorts would then come in. So sometimes when you prop something up and everyone knows it's temporary, everyone's going to wait till it's gone, and as a result, it doesn't go up. So it sometimes produces the opposite effect. People are not coming into the market now because they know QE, all these artificial things are out there and are going to be withdrawn. And who wants to buy the market 5 minutes before they're withdrawn and it falls down? And so when you interfere with the market, it has consequences. Now, do I know whether the props are keeping it up more, or the fear of the props being withdrawn, or the inevitability is keeping it lower than it would otherwise be? I don't know. I just know that the price at which the market clears today would probably be different if those weren't there, and that creates an uncertainty that slows investment also. So I'd say starting to get rid of these things would be a good idea. Now, the reason why we have them there in the first place is absolutely valid. We had to prevent the U.S. from going into deflation, which is the worst thing you can have. If we have a little of inflation as a result, there's a playbook for dealing with that. You don't like it, but it's better. So my net of all this stuff is the U.S. this stuff is going to be withdrawn. It'll have some shock. The day they announce QE is going up, market goes down that day, and then it climbs back up because other people will start to feel it's safer to go back in. So I think, it'll undoubtedly have short-term effect and everybody's dreading it. But 2 months ago, we thought we were going to have it already and the market was still at the highs. Personally, I thought they should have started that process the last Fed meeting.
Okay. Can you comment on too big to fail concept and then tie into whether you think the banking industry is under or over-regulated?
The two
and
big.
And let me add one last point. How can we, the audience, or what can we, the audience, do to help get rid of government oversight and interference?
Well, you can't get, you know, well, anyway, the too big to fail, the too big to fail is a couple of different things. It goes to, well, if you're too big to fail, then people must be lending to you, since you can't fail, then people who are lending to you are lending to you more cheaply than they otherwise would, and therefore you have an advantage and you are out-competing smaller institutions because you have an unfair advantage over them because you can't fail but they can fail, and so they get charged higher interest rates than you. It's actually not right, and if you look at the interest rates and where things trade, big institutions borrow more cheaply than small institutions, but the margin is totally explained by the fact that big institutions are safer than small institutions and they don't go under in as much, whether it's in banking or in manufacturing or chemicals or natural resources or anything else. It doesn't bear up under real analysis and scrutiny, but it is clearly touches a real nerve in America, and for good reasons, that in the financial crisis, banks, not because people wanted to help the banks, people didn't want to help the banks, just the opposite. But in order to help the financial system, you had to help the banks, which was very distasteful, or it was felt that they had to help the banks, which was very distasteful and generated the resentment that takes the form of trying to do things that that take the notion of making it more easy for institutions to fail, which, would, by the way, is not really what you want to have happen anyway, because the banks are, again, and this is, you know, throughout America, banks are different than other industries. They are, because one thing is they are totally a function, like money itself. It's by fiat. It's confidence. If you have an issue, if BP has an issue, as it has, and you drive up to a corner and there's a BP gas station on one corner, Exxon on the other, and the BP is 3 cents cheap, you're going to buy BP. You can have all the problems in the world, but, you know, something that's still viable as a company, as long as it has, you know, more assets and liabilities. Financial institution, if you get unnerved about a financial institution for 1 second, even if it's not justified, even if it's not right, without hesitating or investigating, you're going to pull your money out of it and put it in another one, because it runs on confidence. And these whole issues, and that's why it's a different thing, and it's a so you cannot separate it from government, because government provides the confidence, or alternatively undermines the confidence. And so you try to, you know, it sounds hypocritical to say that, who doesn't think that a banking system needs a lender of last resort? It has to, because money itself is by fiat, a dollar's worth something because it says it is. And so we learned that the U.S. hates that concept. We didn't have a central bank in this country until 1913. It's been a warring in this country since Hamilton and Jefferson and Jackson and Biddle and everything between the banks, and because America doesn't like concentrations of economic power. It's the nature of the country to do it, but you can't avoid backing up financial institutions and the credit of the country, because if you become, what happened in the financial crisis is, I was worried about an institution, and because you didn't know about any other institution, you just didn't know. Did I think J.P. Morgan was under? Did somebody really think that Goldman Sachs was in some? Who knows what they thought? What they were going to make sure is no money is going to leave my house and go to that house until I'm sure. Well, it's a financial system. I author money to come out of my shop because I know money's coming in. If money doesn't come in, money doesn't go out. So that gets blocked, and there's only one balance sheet in the world big enough to solve the blockage. It's the government saying, it's all right, I know they're solving, go ahead, because I'll back it up. And then it gets unclogged, and then it goes on. You need that lender of last resort to come in and do that. You cannot have a banking system that doesn't have that. And that feeds the beast and the problem and the worry of a too big to fail issue. And it's going to be a hard one to sort out, because at the core of the American culture, no one likes that authority that a Federal Reserve has, unelected, has to make decisions so consequential that even Congress can't make.
Okay, we're going to two more questions. Is that okay? So you want to comment on the Moody's downgrade that everyone saw in the press this morning?
That was totally expected. Moody's had, because of the too big to fail issue, the government was assumed to be supporting the banks. As a result of Dodd-Frank and other things, they removed that government support from their view of the solvency of banks, and that was worth two units to them, and at the same time actually upgraded the bank's credit one unit for a net down one, which everybody knew about, which was why it had no effect on share prices. That was all, that was expected.
Okay, and then last question. Can you comment and expand on the Goldman Sachs charity initiatives? One, to help 10,000 women in developing countries, and the second one, helping 10,000 small businesses.
You know, I'm going to do this very briefly and say, we the people of our firm really want to get involved in initiatives. We write a lot of checks to people and philanthropies, and probably statistically, I think there's never more than one or two firms, even though we're not as big as a lot of firms, who probably commit more to philanthropy than we do. But with a big part of our dollars, we reserve not for the check writing for sustenance and good causes that other people work on, but rather our programs that we do. And because we like to do things that are in our wheelhouse. So what we like to do is we like to support entrepreneurs and business people. And in those programs that you're talking about, for example, 10,000 small businesses, we, in various cities around the country, recruit business people, small business people, who already have going concerns, but maybe that have between 5 and 50 employees that we think we can grow. We put the entrepreneur through, in effect, a mini MBA, which has courses like, you know, negotiation and accounting and business planning and different elements like that. We have partners, educational partners who do this. We provide mentorship, business planning, and in most cases, financing. And then we watch them, and then we help their businesses along, and we think we have like 5,000 of these. We're about to start in Detroit, which is needy but difficult to do because it's hard to find good partners to work with, good educational institutions, and good partners who can help us allocate and select the businesses and monitor them. And it's basically our own little kind of small business initiative, but not just having people apply for loans and granting them loans, but really staying with them, because it also has a bearing on what we do as a company. You know, when people are in businesses, everybody wants to make money, but you also, you know, you do something for 30-something years, you have to believe in it. And we believe in that the most important thing that what we do is we help people finance businesses, grow businesses, hire people who then earn money for their families, who go out and buy products that drive other people's businesses and create wealth. And when we get asked about entrepreneurialism, about philanthropy, I never let it go by the boards but to say, yes, we do a lot of things in philanthropy, but the thing that we do that does the most good in the world is the thing that we do in our core business, which is help people who want to be entrepreneurs get financing, get investments, and stick with them and help their companies grow so they can go out and hire more people, and they in turn could start their own businesses.
Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.